one of the staff associates at the Covey Leadership Center was giving a time management seminar to a group of executives, and I heard that story, shared it with the men at our retreat, and it was one of those kinds of things that I thought, boy, you know, I'm going to have to stuff that thing into a sermon somewhere. It is so good. And yet, as I began to study this last final speech between King David and his son Solomon and the nation Israel, I thought, boy, this would be a great illustration for that. And so I have often heard that if you say something, people will remember it, a little bit of it for a little while, but if they see and not only hear but see something, they will remember it for a lot longer. And this is one of those principles that I hope that you will remember for the rest of your life. What I want to do is attempt a demonstration to help do that. I need the help of an assistant, a volunteer, to help me demonstrate this illustration. Mr. John Cooper in here?
Bert?
He helped me first hour. I pulled him out, and then he's going to be willing to. You sat over here for it. You were hiding over there, weren't you?
He gave me the wrong door.
Sorry, just don't misbehave like you did first hour, okay? I have an empty plastic container and some large rocks. How many of you think that I can fit all these rocks into this empty container? Thank you, son. I appreciate that. I will try my best. All right, one. I'm putting rocks into a container. That's one, two. I practiced this 6 times in my garage. I want you to know that. So I've just about got this thing down. These rocks grow in my backyard, by the way. I've got too many of them. Take them home with you. Start your own rock collection if you'd like. Okay. That is 4 and 5. I'm cheating a little bit because these are sticking up, but I do have all of them in the jar. Hold your applause. Okay. Now, is this a container full? That's right. It is not. All right, John, if you want to grab that gravel there, and we're going to pour some gravel in here, all right? There are no trick mirrors up here. This is... Very good, John. Now, is the container full? Afterward, we're going to have an Old Testament stoning is what we're going to have. All right. John, I'll let you pour the water. Go ahead. That's good. That's good. Huh? Is it full? Yes, it is. Thank you, John. Now, what he went on to say was, as he gave this seminar, was that these rocks represent the major things in your life. After he finished this illustration, he asked his group, now, what does this illustration prove? What is the moral of the story? And I found myself, as I heard it and then read it later, saying, well, what this means is that you have the main things in your life, and then if you work real hard, and you're clever, and you turn, and you twist, and you push and pull, you can get a lot of other little events into your life. Is that what you'd say? He went on to say that that wasn't right. So I was wrong, and many of you who agreed with me were. And then he went on to tell the principle behind it. What we're going to do is attempt to do that. I'm going to take these big rocks back out. Let me put them right here. Okay, let me pour a little bit. Okay, kids, do not try this at home. We are professionals.
Yes, we are.
All right. He went on to say that the main idea is simply this. I'm going to try to put these rocks back in. Now, I guess I could turn a little bit, but they would be well above the edge. The principle is make sure you put the big rocks in first. Say that with me. Make sure you put the big rocks in first. Thank you, John. Would you help me?
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ken. What I want to do is take you to the book of 1 Kings again as we continue our study there. If you'll find your place in 1 Kings chapter 2, and then also find your place in the book of 1 Chronicles. You know where that is now if you were with us last Lord's Day. I want to show you David's rather passionate challenge to his son and the nation. A challenge that in effect said, make sure you put in the big rocks first. You probably have heard the phrase, the tyranny of the urgent. What I want to do is rephrase that for our purposes this morning, and I hope that it will come back to your mind over and over again. We'll call it the tyranny of the gravel. That is, having things in our lives that rush and push and pull, and we put them in, and then we try to stuff on top of them the main events, the main things. The truth is, most of us are mastered by the non-essential. We are subjugated by this cruel taskmaster, and so often we come to the end of our week and we wonder how in the world we were able to do all of those little things, and yet we've missed the main things. One more week again. It's time, I think, we took a hard look at our schedules and distinguished between rock and gravel. Now, in this text, all of the rocks that are to be in our lives as believers are not mentioned, but we'll just simply mention three that surface. These are not profound. They are a refresher course for every believer. But let me give you the rock or the principle, and then we will look at the text. Rock number one is a close relationship with God. Now look at 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, saying, I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. By the way, these are the same words that Moses told Joshua just before Moses died. Now, flip over to 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and look at verse 9. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father. You could circle the word know. You could also circle the word your. David is saying, I'm not telling you to do something I've never done. Know the God of your father, Solomon, and serve him with a whole heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. Now, whenever a father tells a son or a daughter to do something, to live a certain way, immediately to that child's mind, as it did to yours, you interpret that phrase in light of how you saw your dad or your mom live. Now, Solomon at this time is about 12 or 13 years of age, and he's had an opportunity to closely watch his dad's life for maybe 5 or 6 years. And so as I thought about how Solomon received this message from his dad, and how David's life intersected Solomon's and what Solomon would have seen his dad do, I have decided to give you just a couple of things that I think must have gone through Solomon's young mind as to what it means to know God and to serve Him. The first is, we'll call it this, submission in spite of God's refusals. Look back at the beginning of this chapter to verse 2. Then King David rose to his feet. Now he's speaking to the nation. And he said, listen to me, my brethren and my people. I had intended to build a permanent home for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. Did you catch those words? I had intended to build. A couple of years ago, we had the privilege of studying together this passionate desire of David to build a house for the glory of God's presence. It would be a permanent temple that would replace the movable tent or tabernacle. Now, after 15 years of fighting and subduing the enemies, the nation Israel begins to experience peace for the first time. Now, at this point and juncture in David's ministry, he formulates and finishes all of his plans for this house that he has been thinking about, evidently, for a long period of time, for years, if not decades. And he goes to Nathan the prophet, and he says, Nathan, now that we have peace in the land, I want to build God a home, a place where His glory can reside. And Nathan said, David, that sounds great. The answer is yes. Problem is, that night, that next night, God came to Nathan and said, Nathan, you made a mistake. Go back and tell David the answer to his lifelong dream is not yes, it's no. And I, along with you, were a little shocked and upset as we heard that message relayed to him by the prophet. Well, it's in verse 3 of this book that we're told why. We studied it then. Let's review it again. But God said to me, David continues, you shall not build a house for my name, because you are a man of war and have shed blood. Now slip into David's sandals for a moment. I think this is where most of us would lose it. Those battles were the will of God. Every time we swung the sword, God received the glory. This is what He had commanded, and we had obeyed in faith, and we had shed blood of the enemies of God to conquer this land and subdue it. And now God says, because you have swung the sword, you can't build your lifelong dream. What would David do? A lifelong ambition is rejected. I think in David's heart, he was not really a soldier. He was a builder. I think if we knew David well, we would know that when he pillowed his head at night, he wasn't dreaming up new battle plans. He was formulating building plans. This was his love. I think the mark of our character, ladies and gentlemen, is how we respond to God's refusal more than how we respond to His yes. Has God said no to one of your dreams? Maybe it's a position. Maybe it's an accomplishment. Maybe it's a career. Maybe it's a relationship. And He has said no. Relinquish it. Let it go. One author wrote these interesting words. Listen, and I quote, rather than pining away the last few years of his life with an ache for that unfulfilled desire, David focuses on what the Lord will allow him to do. This leads me to my second point. It is not only submission in light of God's refusal, we'll call it this, gratitude in light of God's allowances. And I want you to look how David goes on, but let's back up to verse 3 again. But God said to me, you shall not build a house for my name, because you are a man of war and have shed blood. Now verse 4, yet, got to circle that word, yet the Lord, the God of Israel, chose me from all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. For He has chosen Judah to be a leader, and in the house of Judah, my father's house, and among the sons of my father, He took pleasure in me to make me king over all Israel. Many Christians are caught in the refusal of God, and they say, God must not love me. He hasn't opened this door. He hasn't allowed me to fulfill this lifelong ambition or this dream. He must not care. And David says, He didn't let me do that, but He has pleasure in me because He chose me to do something else. He allowed me to be a king. Isn't that great? That is knowing God, where the rubber meets the road, when He says no and responding to when He says yes. This is one of those rocks that you need to have in your life. Rock number one is a close relationship with God that really, really, really hits the road with shoes ready to travel. When God says no, okay, Lord, where do you say yes? And I will obey. That's knowing Him. Rock number two is a clear accountability to God's Word. I want you to go back to 1 Kings again, chapter 2. 1 Kings, chapter 2, and look at verse 3. Let's pick up his conversation with Solomon. He says, keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in His ways, to keep His statutes, His commandments, His ordinances, and His testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn. You know, David knew the depths of moral and spiritual failure, didn't he? He knew the consequences of an unaccountable life. In fact, he would pay the penalty for those sins of murder and adultery till the day he died. He knew that the only guideline that could help steer his son Solomon through the maze of life's temptations would be the written word. It's as if he said, son, study the law. Get to know Moses real well. Study the ordinances and the commands, the precepts and the insights. This Old Testament book, that which was written, the Pentateuch, the Torah, the law, this book is a rock. Put it first. Now, ironically, something occurred as I studied these passages. Something occurs in his conversation with Solomon that was confusing at first, but then later revealed that David was failing even a little bit at this point. And it comes out in verse 5. Would you look there, 1 Kings 2, verse 5. Now, you also know what Joab, David says, the son of Zeruiah did to me, what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner and to Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace. And he put the blood of war on his belt about his waist and on his sandals on his feet. So act according to your wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol, the grave, in peace. Look at verse 8. And behold, there is with you Shimei, the son of Gera the Benjamite of Baharim. Now it was he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, David says, do not let him go unpunished, for you are a wise man, and you will follow what you ought to do to him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. Wow. Now, at first, I was convinced that David was acting something like a mafia godfather. You know, he's telling his successor who's on the royal hit list. And Solomon, as soon as I'm dead, you bump these people off. The more I studied and researched, it became clear that what's going on is a conversation between David and his son that goes back in time to some of the consequences that were still in existence related to David's disobedience to the law. What we have here are references to unfinished business. You see, there's unfinished business regarding Joab and Shimei that David had failed as the leader to carry out. And now it would be handed to his son, Solomon. Listen to what Dr. Howard Voss wrote. Was this just a piece of Oriental cruelty, as the critics often claim? Not necessarily. Both Joab and Shimei had committed acts worthy of the death penalty. Modern Americans need to remember that ancient Semitic government prescribed the death penalty for many crimes that would not warrant the same treatment today. Dr. Simon DeRais adds these words, listen, as he relates this to Joab. Joab had brought blood upon the house of David, and Solomon's fulfillment of David's command will be to punish Joab for his bloodthirstiness. But most important, the house of David needed to be purged of blood guilt so that it might reign in peace. See, the point is, David should have dealt with these men earlier, but he didn't do it. Why? We can only conjecture why. But if you go back and you study the stories of these two men, as I went back and refreshed my own memory, you'll remember that these two men crossed David's path with these particular sins while David was in the process of reeling from his own sin and the consequences of his own sin. With Shimei, it was Absalom after the throne, and he was about to overthrow David. That David, the failure as a father, reeling from that coup attempt, he leaves, and Shimei comes out while David is fleeing for his life, and Shimei curses the king of Israel and taunts him, ultimately cursing the God who had anointed David. And that was worthy of the death penalty in Israel in that day. But David didn't do anything. With Joab, it's a lot clearer. Joab should have been dealt with by David a long time ago. Joab had murdered two innocent loyal commanders in the Israelite army because they just happened to be in Joab's career path. And so he got rid of them. And David should have acted with justice as Israel's leader, and he failed to do it. Why? We're not exactly sure why, but let me conjecture for a moment. It was Joab who years earlier received a note from David. David was in trouble. David had had an immoral relationship with a woman named Bathsheba. Now Bathsheba was pregnant with his child. Uriah was a loyal soldier, the husband of Bathsheba, and David couldn't figure out a way to resolve this problem. And so he, by the very hand of Uriah, sent a note back to Joab the general, and it said something in effect, Joab, I've got this little problem. Make sure that Uriah doesn't come home from battle alive. And this will be just between the two of us. How do you exact justice then, later, against a man that you had consorted with to commit murder? Frankly, Joab and Shimei were skeletons in David's closet of past sin. And he hadn't dealt with them. And he would pay the consequences for his actions till the day he died. It's as if he were haunted by these two men. I want to address something for just a few moments. It is a heavy subject. Doesn't get a lot of primetime coverage. But it's a tragic thought about something that happens, unfortunately, just about every day. It is the sin of a father or grandfather. The sins of a preacher or a politician or an executive that have to be dealt with later by the living family members. In other words, skeletons in some man's closet that don't come out until that man has died, and his stunned children and his wife, if they are living, and the family and friends around him are left to pick up confusing pieces related to that man's sin. I happen to be a father, but I also happen to be a son. And I want you to know that one of the greatest gifts that my father has given me is a clean name. You know what I mean? I'll bump into someone who knows my father and they will make a comment like, your dad is a godly man. Boy, you don't know what that does for me. I had a gentleman come worship in our church who was traveling through town who knew my father in college. Not a lot of good we can say about our college days, can we? And he said, by the way, before I leave, I just want you to know I knew your father in college and he was such a student of the word. What that did. I was preparing to address the student body at Liberty University a couple of months ago, and their athletic center was filling up with about 4,000 or 5,000 students, and I was off in a little room, and I was meeting there with the campus pastor waiting for the clock to strike. And while we were seated in there, just before time to go out and walk across the gym floor, the president of the university came in, and he opened the door, and he walked over to me, and he thanked me for coming, and he gave me a big warm handshake, and he said, I know your dad. And as we walked across that gym floor, he commended my father's work and his name. Now, I can tell you that speaking to 6,000 or 5 or however many there were was not anywhere as significant as hearing that man say something about my father. Now, maybe you're here and you don't understand that because you haven't experienced that. You are the one person to begin that kind of heritage today. You start it. You begin that. A couple of years ago, I was a member of a church. There was a well-known businessman in that church. He was a leading trustee for years. And he was involved, instrumental in the creation of the college and seminary. He was a wealthy businessman who had contributed much to the Lord's work. He was a stellar individual. I heard from one of the faculty members just a few months ago the story that literally would rip that place apart. He and his wife were in the car. They were backing down their driveway. Their driveway emptied out into a road, and then past the road was a guardrail, and beyond that was a sheer cliff. As they were backing down, for some strange reason no one knows to this day, the accelerator just jammed. It stuck, and they went speeding across that road, and they crashed through the guardrail and went over the cliff, and they both were killed. Everyone mourned. In the days ahead, as his will was being probated in court, to everyone's horror and amazement, a young 20-year-old girl mysteriously appeared, claiming to be his daughter. From an immoral relationship from years before, and she was able to prove it, along with the fact that she had been receiving payments from him for years to keep it a secret. Clean out the skeletons. Clean out the garbage, if there is any. So that you can present to those who follow you a clean name. Don't leave them with the pieces to pick up. Keep short accounts. Put the rock of the Word and your accountability to the Word in your life first. It will help you keep short accounts with sin. You know, Solomon's name means peace. Solomon and Shalom come from the same Hebrew construction. The tragedy is that Solomon would have to begin his reign with bloodshed and intrigue that would rock the nation. Why? Because his son had to deal with the compromise of the father that he failed to take care of before he died. Make sure you put this rock in first. Rock number three, a committed involvement with God's work. Would you turn to 2 Chronicles or 1 Chronicles chapter 28? For all of David's failure and sin, he was referred to as a man after God's own heart. Isn't that wonderful? Doesn't that give us hope? Not because David was perfect, but because ultimately, as you and I will read in just a moment, God was his priority. You see, by the time of David's death, his worship choruses were being sung all through the kingdom. His solidification of the nation Israel was a heroic achievement. His development of their worship system was an act of faith in the one true God. He was a great man. And God would be ultimately his priority. Now in this final scene, in this last recorded conversation with his son, his heart for God is revealed all over again. I want to give it to you in two ways. First of all, in that we see David communicating a sense of destiny to his son. Look at 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 9 again. You can almost hear and see David saying, Solomon, come here and pull up a chair and I want you to listen. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. Now notice verse 10. Consider now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be courageous and act. Can you imagine young Solomon hearing these words? Imagine if you had one more conversation, just one more with your son or your daughter. What would you say? Now look, sweetheart, son, I want you to get a good education. I want you to get a good job, one you enjoy. Make a decent living. One you'll do your best at. Whatever it is. Marry a nice young boy. Or marry a nice young Christian boy. Marry a nice young Christian girl. Raise a family. Settle down. Be a good law-abiding citizen. I frankly feel that's what we communicate to our children. You know, life's little instruction book, we've got a copy too. All those wonderful things, brush your teeth, tip the waitress, and lock the back door at night. All those things are wonderful, ladies and gentlemen, but they are all temporary, and they all miss the principle of life, the issue of life, why God has you and I on this planet to begin with. How temporary. I saw a cartoon that illustrated it well. Man is jogging, he's huffing and puffing and sweating, and underneath the cartoon is the caption. He's saying something to the effect, I'm doing whatever I can to prolong my life, hoping one day I'll figure out what it's for. How many parents are preparing their children and also living with the idea that God has something special for your life? Whether you're a preacher or a painter, it doesn't matter. You can give God glory with your life, and whatever you find yourself in as you follow Him in His Word, that is His appointment for you. Live there with all that you are and have. God has a special plan for your life. That's passing to your son and daughter a rock-like principle. That's living yourself, whether you're married without children or single, that is living with a rock-like principle that God has a place for your life. I like the way David adds the words, the latter part of verse 10. Did you notice? Be courageous. Now he sounds like a dad. And act. Do it, son. Don't be courageous and talk. Be courageous and act. There's a second thing. David communicated a passionate desire for God's glory. Would you look at verse 11? Same chapter. Then David gave to his son Solomon the plan of the porch of the temple, its buildings, its storehouses, its upper rooms, its inner rooms, and the room for the mercy seat. And the plan of all that he had in mind, I like that, in mind, for the courts of the house of the Lord. Can you just see David and Solomon around a table? And David has unrolled all the blueprints. And he's pointing out, here's where this hallway goes, and here's how big this room will be, and here's how it all empties out. And Solomon, this has been my passionate desire, this house. You're going to get to build it for God's glory. Amazing thing is, that David got so excited. And the next chapter tells how he emptied all of his personal accounts into the building of that temple. He's so excited about giving and talking and planning, something he will never see. I've been in the offices of people that have businessmen who have pictures of buildings with their name on it. They donated the money for it, and it's wonderful and nice of the place to name it after them. But I wonder how many men, how many of us would dedicate our lives to something and donate our monies to something we would never see. See, when you do something for God's glory, it really doesn't matter. I read the Statue of Liberty towers 151 feet in the air, weighs 200 tons. Ortholdi, the French sculptor, did the work. Oscar Hammerstein saw a picture of that lady from an aerial position, a helicopter flying overhead, and he once remarked how amazed he was at the detail in her hair, at the top of her head. And he remarked what was interesting to him was that Bartholdi lived before the helicopter or the airplane were invented. He could rest assured that no one would ever see the top of her head. But with as much dedication and skill, he shaped the contours of her hair with the same precision as he did her gown and her face. You see, if you have a passion for God's glory, it doesn't matter if anybody will ever see it. With your work, it will be done right. It will be done well. It means performing the tedious with as much intensity as the exciting. You say, I can't live like that. I'm geared for what's visible and what's seen. I would be tempted to quit all of those things that are done in the daily disciplines of life. Well, I think David knew that he would be tempted to quit as well. Look at verse 20. Then David said to his son Solomon, "Be strong and courageous and act." There it is again. Do it, boy. "Do not fear nor be dismayed." I love this. "For the Lord God, my God, is with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you until all the work of the service of the house of the Lord is finished." Isn't that great? Just make sure you put Solomon, the main rocks, in first. A firm conviction and desire to know him, a close relationship with the word that you have, and a commitment to serve him and bring him glory with all that you are, wherever you are. Those are the big rocks around which all the gravel of life should settle. You know what, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of your week, do you look back over your shoulder and wonder, why didn't I have time to read the Word? I just didn't have time. Why didn't I have time to talk with my spouse or play with my kids or write my folks or whatever it might? Why don't I have time to get to know the Lord deeper, better? I want you to look with me, and then we'll close here quickly. Some of David's last recorded words, 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 10. We don't have time to read the whole prayer, but what great last words. So David blessed the Lord in the sight of all the assembly. And David said, "Blessed art thou, O Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. Indeed, everything that is in the heavens and the earth, thine is the dominion, O Lord, and thou dost exalt thyself as head over all. Both riches and honor come from thee, and thou dost rule over all, and in thy hand is power and might, and it lies in thy hand to make great and to strengthen everyone. Now, therefore, our God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name." Aren't those great words? Look at verse 28. "And David died in a ripe old age, full of days, riches, and honor, and his son Solomon reigned in his place." There is a New Testament postscript to David's life. We could call it his epitaph. Let me just read it to you. It's found in the book of Acts. Listen to what Paul said as he preached. "For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers." Paul didn't say, after David brilliantly led the people, After David amassed a personal fortune, after David developed the blueprints for the temple of God, after all of that, after David served the purpose of God in his own generation. For you, it might be changing a diaper. It might be developing a contract. It might be a myriad of things. But when we come to the end of our life, can it be said of us, we fulfilled the purpose of God in our own generation? You know how it can be? If you and I will simply put the big rocks in first.